Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and joining me for Somewhat New Movie Day here on Double Feature is Michael Kester.
Oh man, yeah, Somewhat New Movie Day. How about that?
It's my favorite day of the year where I watch a film that has come out in the last year instead of in 1970.
My favorite day of the year is when we pair two movies that are still in the theater.
Yeah, what are the, these movies aren't in the theater anymore. Good try though.
No.
We can't even do that, right? We can't even get that right. New Movie Day is movies that are 2 years old.
Uh-huh.
What are the two movies?
Well, we're going to do Only God Forgives, and we're also going to do Django Unchained. Not to be confused with Jesus Uncrossed.
Or Django, which we've already previously covered.
Or Tsukiyaki Western Django,
yeah,
or Django Returns.
There's about 99 more Djangos that we'd like to get to, but we already covered that on Django. Why don't we do these in reverse order as well? Is that all right?
That's a good idea.
Yeah. We'll swap them. It'll be great. Mary Beth Gardner kind of sponsored today's episode of the show. She just wants you to go to One Fund Boston. It's secure.onefundboston.org. But I would speculate you might also be able to get there by just going to onefundboston.org. O-N-E. She also doesn't like spoilers, so she'll use the... I don't know if she likes spoilers or not. But you can use the chapters to skip over the spoilers in case you haven't seen Django. You can skip right over to Only God Forgives, which I, you know, will try and spoil, but fucking reffin, man.
Mm-hmm.
Django being the two films of the two films, Django Unchained being the one that I totally get.
Sure.
And we're going to fucking start there. And I think we probably don't have time for the cast and cameos, right? I mean, look them up.
We definitely don't.
They're great. Amber Tamblyn, Zoe Bell, Baghead number two. There's a Marconi
sure.
score.
John Jarrett.
Yeah, right.
Fucking,
right?
I mean, everybody's in this movie. If you don't know they're in this movie, they're in this movie. And all the people that you knew were in this movie do a fantastic job. Is that good enough?
I think that's good enough. The only other thing I wanted to mention was the participation. What is it? The
friendly participation.
With friendly participation of Franco Nero.
So I think
that's what everybody's always looking for anyways, right?
I think the Franco Nero is probably something outside of a cameo or performance note.
Sure.
Franco Nero has one of, and I'm not just saying this because of the cameo. I'm saying this because of what it brings to the film.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite roles in Django Unchained. He's the guy whose Mandingo is fighting with Calvin's Mandingo when we first meet Calvin.
Right.
Now, we've seen Franco Nero on the show before, which is impressive because he doesn't do a whole lot of movies.
Uh-huh.
Franco Nero is Django, the original Django, the Django that started all other Djangos.
Right.
And basically, he gets a scene to pass the torch.
Yeah.
But he also is the strongest nod to, it's almost a Hinduistic reincarnation idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Django isn't necessarily a man, but instead he's an icon. He's an idea that embodies based on the desire for revenge or based on the strength of one's need to succeed by violent means.
I have to keep telling myself you're not talking about Only God Forgives. I didn't think this is the first time we'd be bringing up the Hinduism already in the show. Yeah, well, and I think the idea of friendly participation of Franco Nero.
Sure.
When a movie feels the need to be officially sanctioned or get the, you know, the blessing of the previous creator, all they're looking for is the line that says the friendly participation of,
sure,
you know, if Rob Zombie had with the friendly participation of John Carpenter at the beginning of the Halloween films, the reception would have been a lot different. You know, it's what people are for some reason clamoring for. But I think it makes a big difference with Django Unchained because Tarantino could be doing a Death Proof thing here where he's just going, yeah, like old exploitation films. Django, bet you never seen that one. But everybody's already done that. There's a million Django sequels.
Sure.
So he does one better. he goes, oh yeah, well, fuck you guys. My Django sequel has Franco Nero in it.
Right.
It's yeah, getting the official participation, the passing of the torch, that Tarantino wants to make sure that when he gets his Blu-ray of Django Unchained, that it sits on his DVD shelf next to all the other Django sequels, and that he can point to it and go, and there was this one notable Django sequel that actually had Franco Nero,
right,
you know, in friendly participation, which I just think is great. So another thing that I think will probably get passed right over, but reminds me I'm in Tarantino territory and having a great fucking time, is the brutal bursts of gore.
Oh yeah.
Just pound after pound, sure, of it in this movie.
Quentin Tarantino is probably one of the few directors and filmmakers that we get to cover on Double Feature and then talk about not only the film, but all the things people are saying.
Yeah, right, right.
We get to hone in what we actually find important from not only the film itself, but from what people are garnering from the film, and we get to tell them they're wrong. Or right, right, kind of pat Tarantino on the back and go, hey, good job. These people are seeing the best parts of your movie.
Yeah, sure.
People said that Django Unchained was the most violent of Tarantino's films.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think that the scenes of violence in this film are probably the most effective. I always go back to say goodbye to Miss such and such. What? Say goodbye to Miss such and such.
Sure. Yeah.
Goodbye, Miss such and such. Bang, out the door.
Yeah, sure, sure.
The impact of the violence is definitely stronger because it's coming from a genre whose violence was always,
right,
tantamount to the actual, I don't know, gravity of the lead character.
Sure.
But the other thing about Django Unchained, aside from Quentin Tarantino exploding in a bloody mass and squibs on squibs on squibs for each, yeah, single bullet, and blood spattering into the, what is it? Snow? Oh, cotton. Ours was snow.
Yeah, sure.
They stole our snow, blood on snow idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And put it on cotton. This movie got taken to task for using the word nigger.
Yeah, strange, isn't it? Although, funny enough, Tarantino doesn't use it in the film.
Right.
Which, you know, is just, you know, him fucking playing with people, just, right, toying with people, because he's used it in his other films.
Sure.
And he has famously said it in his other films, and fucking Spike Lee throws a bitch fit every time Tarantino makes a film. Yeah, the racial stuff is, I think, some of the most obvious stuff in the movie, and it's weird seeing, the first time I saw it, you know, it was really all I could think about. It was dominating, you know, my mental conversation. And now upon watching it again, one, I love the film much more than the first time I saw it.
That's good. I was actually going to ask, because I remember you saying that and me being scared for you.
You know, it was stupid. I saw it with somebody who wasn't really into it, and I think it kind of drug me down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I watch it now and I go, oh yeah, one of the best Tarantino movies, mm-hmm, which is every Tarantino movie is, sure, one of the best.
Yeah, fortunately.
Tarantino movies. But, you know, the other things he's doing in the movie, even outside of the racial stuff, I honestly think is more interesting.
Agreed.
Things like the, you know, we were talking about the gore, but the violence is different in every Tarantino movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, oh, there's more of it, or he's pushed it in new ways. He's doing it in a there, you know, Kill Bill, definitely a couple movies that are violent as fuck.
Right.
In the samurai sense. In,
sure,
the thin-blooded, squirty
Shogun assassin.
Yeah. That is not the way Django is violent. Mm-mm. Django is violent in the, you know, explosive gobs of blood sort of sense. And it's not as if there's blood in every single scene. There's, you know, there's these little bursts of it. His ability to do violence differently in different movies to the effect of the stories he's telling, and more importantly, the environment he's in, that's a very unique Tarantino thing.
Mm-hmm.
Another unique Tarantino thing I just totally fucking forgot about, being lost in the, you know, time this movie came out in theaters, right next to Lincoln and everybody's talking about race, is scenes of Django Unchained, just the individual scenes are better than entire films.
Sure.
Every fucking scene in this movie, And I think Pulp Fiction's a really good example of this, but you can go back to Inglourious Basterds as well. You recall these films and think about, oh yeah, that was a really good movie. It had this scene or that scene or that scene. And in Django Unchained, that is basically every scene for 3 fucking hours is, it appeals to the TV watching marathoning person in me, who is somehow seeing a series of, you know, individual scenes rather than 1 3-hour epic movie. I realized that right about when they got to, it was early in the movie, but shooting the sheriff and the entire town is waiting outside. And the way that scene is constructed, there's two unknowns there. What the fuck is going to happen, which should be the gripping question of basically every scene ever, and why it happened, which is a unique thing. He comes in, he shoots the sheriff. He seems to have a very calm demeanor. This happens to them a couple times throughout the movie, but later you sort of know. But there's this lingering, why did that happen? What the fuck is going to happen now? And seeing that mystery revealed throughout this little 5-minute section of the movie is so captivating for me. It's better than some entire films. And I don't know, I just kind of forgot about Tarantino's ability to do things like this, to create incredibly memorable scenes that are driven by his characters, that are driven by an element of mystery, that you just want to know, okay, I love these two guys. They're really unique and enigmatic, and what the fuck are they going to do here?
Well, and you also get within the film these different levels of legend, and they're always coming from weird places. Because you'd think in your standard spaghetti Western film that all your legend would be, I don't know, maybe Native American, maybe legends of cowboys past. But instead, one of the first legends that you get that the film pays any allegory to is the German legend of Brunhilde.
Well, and I think that makes it even more dynamic than, say, Inglourious Basterds, which had a lot of that. But there were players in different factions of pro or anti-Nazi. It was a little bit more black and white, although the characters, again, still come from a place of incredibly interesting background and interesting motivation. And that's why you want to watch these characters, why you're captivated by them. It's also in the way the characters are introduced. You know, I thought a lot of, this time when I saw it, about the division of the film. I think of Django Unchained as Candy,
right?
I mean, it's Calvin, and he's one of the big forces that dominates the movie. But the movie fucking goes on for an hour before you even see him, before you're even introduced or really get characters talking about him.
Well, he's an afterthought even in the plot. He's not the goal of the situation. He just happens to be the one who owns Brunhilde. And then on top of that, you really only ever see him in one of two places, which is in a cart or in his home. But you're right. He's the gravitas of the film. He's certainly what drew a huge audience to it.
When you get to that scene where you're introducing him, it is larger than life. They're trying to make sure he doesn't look anything like any of the other characters. He doesn't get introduced the way you would typically introduce someone. Completely throws everybody off. So there's a sense of drama that you're being introduced to this force that doesn't play by the rules. And finally, you know, a contender for these characters who otherwise have been able to get out of any situation they're thrown in. Camera whips into his reaction shot, you know, sound effect and all, which is great. But I mean, I think Tarantino knows, all right, this character is going to be the pivotal point of a film that you're already loving. And once, you know, once Candy enters into things, it's going to be hard to consider other things. He's going to dominate a lot of scenes. So they gave the previous characters time to be enjoyed on their own. They have this, it almost feels like an era before you get to the DiCaprio chapter of the movie.
It's kind of like Edgar Wright's theory on superhero films. He's doing a superhero movie. He was asked about the villain in the movie. He said he's not paying attention to the villain because you need a movie to build a hero. And if you spend the time building a hero and a villain, both of them aren't going to be good enough for each other. So what Tarantino manages to do in Django Unchained is basically build the hero throughout the movie. And then at the point where you would need the hero and the villain to start facing off, he introduces an entirely constructed villain and deconstructs him for the remainder of the film.
Yeah.
Because when he's introduced, he's too good.
Yeah, right.
You get the heroes who you have watched grow as a perfect machine of a heroic team.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly they're faced with, automatically, off the bat, Calvin Candy is too good. He's going to beat them.
Yeah.
And you need to watch him get deconstructed and more humanized before you can even imagine them going head to head with him.
Sure.
And then right about the time he's too human to even feel like a force to be reckoned with, they reach the plantation. They introduce the fucking underhanded Samuel L. Jackson's character.
Oh, yeah.
And now you have a face off.
Yeah. Steven's a real interesting one in that conversation about race. You know, and the movie's, it's very aware of that. I don't want to sound like it's not having that
sure
dialogue. I mean, Don Johnson is explaining the difference between a free slave and a slave,
sure,
and that free is not the same as white.
Yeah.
It's establishing there are different, it's almost a gradient of freedom,
mm-hmm,
of treatment in the environment we're in. But Samuel Jackson's character is, again, this is a guy who is, mm-hmm, in the Calvin camp of things.
Right.
You might not expect that from an actor like Samuel Jackson. You think,
sure,
Tarantino's creating this movie, Django Unchained. It's going to talk about the South. It's going to talk about racism.
Man.
Yeah, you're thinking about the other Tarantino characters.
Mm-hmm.
He's not playing the easy card he has, which is that Samuel Jackson loves him and will be in his films.
Right.
Samuel Jackson is not Django.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Samuel Jackson plays a much more interesting, challenging character for him as an actor.
Sure.
And then you have a more of a wild card like Jamie Foxx, who has not been in other Tarantino movies, is now going to play your hero.
Right.
I mean, just from a casting standpoint, a really incredibly
right
interesting way to mix those characters up. Not the obvious choices at all.
One of the most deeply underlying beats that the film goes through is the slow realization that Calvin is a crazy rich white person and Steven owns him.
Yeah, right.
It seems, you know, Steven pulls him into a room, explains to him what's going on because Calvin is too rampant and excitable and francophilic to really pay attention.
Right.
Steven has to bring him up to speed on the real goings on of the situation, and it's because Steven doesn't like it.
Yeah.
If Steven didn't have a problem with these characters, he wouldn't say a thing to Calvin and they would get away with it.
Sure.
And then you get these other weird and bizarre elements. I don't know if I didn't notice it the first time I watched the film, but the second time through, when Django's killing everybody at the plantation before he blows up Steven,
sure,
before he shoots his knees out.
Right.
Right before that face off, Steven lets go of his cane, stands up straight without a hunch, walks toward him without a limp.
Right.
Because he's been putting on this whole performance to make Calvin feel like he's got the powerful situation. Meanwhile, Steven is,
sure,
literally running the house.
When you're talking about the finale of the film, too, mm-hmm, which is strangely different than this climax. And this is always something that Django Unchained did, and Tarantino uses in a mixed way through his movies, but it's a really odd decision in constructing the film. You have a bloodbath showdown at the end of this, which I almost didn't expect to get for some reason. Again, just forgetting what kind of director I'm watching. But we're in this huge house, we're in this mansion, and Christoph's character is walking towards DiCaprio's character with his fucking hand outstretched. And it's just this moment where the whole audience eventually hits this point of realization right before the gun is pulled that, all right, this is going to be it. That first shot is fired and there's dead air. There's a moment to let it sink in as if everything is frozen. Nobody reacts to it in the way that they're about to.
Mm-hmm.
There's just this lingering, he's been shot. What are the implications of this? What does it mean? And there's a moment for it to sink in. And then, like an explosion, the showdown hits. Now, we have this incredible slow motion detailed ballet, the great amount of attention to sound in this scene, the Wild West kind of ricochet effects of the bullets.
Mm-hmm.
Bullets are whizzing by, making the sounds as if they're bombs dropping in a cartoon.
Right.
every single bullet has an explosive force, and there's millions of bullets. So like a fucking gorgeous symphony, we're creating this perfect climax, perfect really textbook climax to a film. Showdown in Mansion, your villain is dead. We're honestly just a few gunshots shy of wrapping the entire story at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Django could very easily, and I think without anybody's criticism, take his wife in his arms, mount his horse, and ride away. At the typical 2.5 hour mark, too.
Right.
I mean, this is textbook perfect. Can't do it any better. Climax of the film. And then Django Unchained fucking pulls out mid-orgasm and just goes, nope, not the end of the movie. And it leaves me wondering, and I mean, I think through our conversation, I have a bunch of great ideas about it, but what is left that is mission critical? Why not end the film at the exact 2.5 hour mark, right after you had your biggest fucking showdown, one of the largest you've ever done in your career as a director, as a writer? Everything about it was flawless and perfect. And in, you know, in a Western, that would be where you would end the film. As we were talking, I'm thinking about that hour we go without candy and how this is really a story about Django. And I think we want to see him complete the rest of his quest without Schultz.
Exactly.
Because they've been a pair since the very beginning. But also, I'm thinking about Steven a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We want to give him his time as the ultimate villain.
Right.
Instead of just the one who's been living in secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've torn away the you know, the aesthetic packaging of candy. He's gone. And now things are up to Steven being revealed as, I don't want to say a puppeteer or anything. I mean, candy owns the place.
Sure.
But Steven is now a force to be reckoned with. And it turns out even larger than candy was.
Well, what you have to realize at that moment in the film is when King kills Candy and then Schultz is killed, the showdown of the film, instead of the notions of this being about a black guy breaking away from the constraints of the oppressive Southern white people, instead becomes this whole notion of right versus wrong and good versus evil.
Yeah.
And don't forget, there's the scene when Django's being told that he's got to play the part of a black slaver.
I was just thinking about
that.
What
he says is, he says a black slaver is the lowest thing there is, even lower than the head house nigger.
Right. Yeah.
And so we get that moment where, well, there is no black slaver. That's not in this movie. But we do have the second worst thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, at that point, Steven becomes the black slaver, doesn't he? I mean, Candy is dead.
Right, exactly.
And it just seems like from what we're given,
he's still got Hildy captive.
Sure.
He's not making any changes.
He is de facto black slaver.
Exactly.
At that point, he's kind of running things.
Exactly. Once you find out he's really running the show, granted, there's, you know, white people who possess the bills of sale.
Right.
He could probably convince them, if he wanted to let 90% of them go, 100% of
them
go.
Sure.
But he doesn't want to because he's comfortable and he's happy and he doesn't care about anyone but himself.
Well, it's making a point of illustrating that he's not among the other black people in the film.
Right.
He is not Django's class. He is not the slave class. He is Candy's class.
Mm-hmm.
He is indistinguishable, you know, trademark ridiculous white eyebrows and all, from the upper white class that is owning the other human beings on this ranch. And that's one of the things that, you know, I mean, just in terms of being honest, thought about race a lot watching it the first time, and then watching it, you know, every subsequent time, thinking maybe that's, I don't want to say misdirection, it's a conversation that's there, but feeling like it's something that Tarantino almost doesn't want you to see. That's why Samuel L. Jackson is playing ultimate badass boss,
exactly,
supervillain,
sure,
unapologetic,
right,
awful human being, you know, lowest of the low. And we're just trying to, we're really trying to tear away the race from the dialogue about race. We're trying to give you all of the beats of the story without making it purely about black and white. Not even just not making it about that, but trying to get as far away from it as we can. This is heroes and villains.
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know,
cowboys,
it's not
and
about
Indians.
Skin color. Yeah. So, you know, the fact that people have this immediate cultural reaction seeing the movie, we're all going to talk about skin color, kind of seems like missing the point.
Right.
But at the same time, I do totally get you. You don't watch Django and not think about that at least the first time you see it. If it doesn't linger every time after, you know, there's scenes. I mean, we're portraying the Klan as buffoons. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about the KKK. Also, Tarantino doing. I mean, this is the power of cinema. Enough people make a memorable goofy Klan scene, and then the popular perception of the Klan is that they're goofy.
Right.
I actually wanted to ask you about that too, as both avid South Park fans. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that South Park has done once or twice. I can think of at least one particularly memorable, you know, mm-hmm. making fun of the Klan thing. I've always loved, and I know we've talked about the Superman radio show, I hope at least one point in the history of our show, as being the way that you tear the Klan down. You just mm-hmm. change the popular perception of what they are.
Right.
And over enough time, that becomes reality. Mm-hmm. People think of the Klan as a bunch of D&D nerds talking about fucking grand wizards and giving secret passcodes, and you destroy their reputation through film. Mm-hmm. It's one of the tangible reality-based powers of film. Did you also notice there was definitely a screw you guys, I'm going home?
Yes, I did notice that.
You think he's...
Absolutely.
He's given a little nod.
I feel like there's said, gotta be.
It was pretty fucking close to screw you guys, I'm going home. Mm-hmm. Anyways, so yeah, a lot of other things in Django was the point I was making. Talking about race without sacrificing... It's as if we're taking all the usual vast number of things that a Tarantino movie has packed into it, and then... just by giving it some kind of, you know, racial setting, we're having that conversation almost as a byproduct. Tarantino isn't setting out to make a movie about race. He's setting out to make a movie about heroes and villains. And the plot, the narrative, happens to be about race. I look at this and think a lot more interesting, especially for a Tarantino movie, are the things he's doing differently in his own career. I mean, look at female roles in this movie. Mm-hmm. All male heroes, basically all male villains. Mm-hmm. He's Tarantino, so he can't help but throw a couple really memorable female roles. But he's even going as far as to make this a rescue your helpless woman movie. Mm-hmm. That seems really... If I just describe Django Unchained to you, the plot of this film... It doesn't seem like a Tarantino narrative.
Right.
Django has lost his wife and he needs to go save her. She's helpless. She can't do anything. You don't get one fucking Tarantino scene where she's in the box outside and they open it and she jumps out and punches somebody in the face.
Right.
There is no ass-kicking female in this movie. Mm-hmm. And we've had these other conversations, especially in the last year or two, about what does it mean to make a feministic movie. I don't think of Django Unchained, despite its all male roles. Knowing Tarantino, he's not making, you know, a chauvinistic movie.
Right.
He's not making really a movie about chivalry in any capacity. It just happens that he's changing things. He doesn't have these empowered female figures. Mm-hmm. And I think you could take an interesting little tidbit like that and rewatch the movie and study it exclusively for what it says about gender roles. I'm so curious about how does this change our conversation about, this is not a movie that is against women. It's a fucking Tarantino movie. Tarantino, I think, has more interesting, dynamic, and certainly heroic female roles than a fucking Sofia mm-hmm. Coppola filmography.
Right.
And then you see something like Django Unchained that it doesn't betray that, but it does something different. And so I'm interested, how does that play into his career, into his body of work? I don't really know the answer, but it's a point of consideration. Another thing that I think Django Unchained is really notable for in the Tarantino body of stuff is a pleasant note that we can go out on, but I think this is finally the movie where he surpassed the constant stigma of Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Of Tarantino's making another movie. But will it be as good as Pulp Fiction? Mm-hmm. Which I thought was, you know, a fucked up stigma to have as a...
Ever since Kill Bill?
Well, ever since Pulp Fiction, even.
Right.
You know, everything Tarantino has touched should be looked at uniquely in its own way. But Kill Bill comes out and people go, yeah, it's even better than Pulp Fiction, or it's not as good as Pulp Fiction. It becomes the barometer for every movie he does.
The reason I allow Jackie Brown to have the Pulp Fiction stigma is because it's the movie after Pulp Fiction. And to be honest, anytime I go see a movie by a director I like, I don't go, will it be his best movie? Will it be better than her first movie? I always go, will it be better than the one they just did? Whether or not I liked it. If I don't like it, I'm asking because I want it to be better. If I loved it, I'm asking because I hope it's not worse.
Sure.
But it's not because I'm trying to compare it directly. I'm just curious where their style has left them in my perception of the film.
Yeah, and I think when you're considering the popular conversation about Tarantino movies, mm-hmm. especially something like Django Unchained, it's a note that in all of the racial conversation that came out of it, I'm really afraid of it being lost. You know, Tarantino fans should take this moment as a really notable period in his career where finally Django Unchained came out and nobody said, well, yeah, but is it going to be Pulp Fiction?
Right.
And that's probably because of its close proximity to Inglourious Basterds. It's probably because of how fucking good Inglourious Basterds was. But Tarantino's career is clearly in a place where he can just make movies now and people aren't going to keep fucking comparing them to Pulp Fiction.
Right.
As if all they want him to do is make other Pulp Fictions. And that also says something. It gives a certain credibility to the audience mm-hmm. that they can recognize, oh, there's other fucking stories to tell. There's other things. You know, Tarantino's still doing interesting things. He's not just that guy who made Pulp Fiction. I wish he'd make another one of those. Only God Forgives, coming right after Drive, couldn't mm-hmm. be a better thing for me to be thinking about as you said that.
He's directed four, I think, mm-hmm. four movies that I think are in the public eye, which are Bronson, Valhalla Rising, Drive, and now Only God Forgives, which you'll notice sure. we've actually covered all four of them on Double Feature.
And yet somehow still scare the crap out of me. It's a great feeling to watch and not get everything the first time.
Yeah.
Or really maybe even not get most things.
Mm-hmm.
I think watching Only God Forgives, there's a very small part of it that I know I understand. And most of it, I'm really excited to talk to you about it and see what the fuck you think is happening
right.
in this movie. Let me give you the 20% that I sure. get really quick. Sure. Movie looks gorgeous. Some David Lynch-y stuff. I mean, I think that's where my area is. It's shot in really, it's got these great colorful backgrounds. It really capitalizes on the Bangkok nightlife kind of scene.
Mm-hmm.
Rough and shooting stuff with colorful backgrounds and natural skin tones, which is an aesthetic I love. It's all neon and it could be really washed out in color, but it's incredibly sharp. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things when I look through the movies he's made and how they've evolved.
Yeah.
This seems to come in an aesthetic style a little bit back towards Valhalla Rising.
Mm-hmm.
But when you watch Valhalla Rising, very independent and just from a technical aspect, a lot of the things they're doing to kind of dodge and burn color, I don't want to say they deteriorate the visual quality, but you don't get anything nearly as sharp or crisp as you do in Only God Forgives.
Mm-hmm.
From just a cinematography point of view, you know, and our ongoing conversations about color, and I cannot wait to see the movie Barcode
yeah.
for Only God Forgives. But to do everything and keep it crisp and sharp, and that difference in skin tone between everything else that's washed out and red, or not washed out, just, you know, really fucking red, really fucking blue, a lot of neons. Revan's just a guy who, he's interesting to me as a filmmaker for his inspirations, for a lot of his methods, the projects. This new thing he's got going on with Gosling, I hope that keeps happening.
Right.
He shoots, and I think this was true of Drive as well, but he shot a lot of this movie in order and then edited the footage the same day he shot it, which is just extremely admirable to anybody who's ever worked on film, probably right. wishes they could work that way
mm-hmm.
because you have this whole project you do shooting the movie and then this whole second project you do
right.
editing the movie.
And you split up the vision a little bit when you're shooting and sure. then editing. If you're shooting, you have it in mind and then you can go in and do it. And then you know what you've got so that the next scene can be more tailored to what you've got edited.
Right. Definitely. So we start to get into, you know, he even credits Alejandro, I think it's Jodorowsky. We talked about The Holy Mountain
mm-hmm.
on Valhalla Rising and a lot of that inspiration. And I mentioned the Jodorowsky thing on there and, you know, not really understanding a lot of that surrealist film.
Right.
I mean, I get Dali stuff. I have the basic understanding of surrealism. We intersect with it in, you know, he gives a special thanks to Gaspar Noé. I mean, we covered Irreversible. Mm-hmm. I don't think we talked about Gaspar Noé's Placebo video enough.
Right.
But, you know, we've talked about him a little bit. And then also watching Only God Forgives, I see the end product too. I see it's like David Lynch is still making films.
Sure.
When you're in that karaoke lounge, the checkerboard floor, the red ornaments hanging, light ornaments from the ceiling. It's a very Twin Peaksy Blue Velvet kind of vibe. Even that wall of sound when they're in the post, you know, walk alley beatdown scene, just having these waves of ambient noise surrounding you. I see that and I get that it's a lot about feelings, and I think we can reference our other David Lynch conversations for where surrealism intersects with mood and tone and just getting an audience to feel a certain thing.
I think when you're dealing with Refn films, there are two really important things to take into account as far as understanding what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I always typically pick up on in any film, which is, which type of exploitation is this movie making an artistic film out of?
Right.
But in Refn, I think it's a little bit very obvious and a little bit buried because you take Drive and it's very easy to go, that's an artistic roadsploitation movie, but it's not looking at the elements of roadsploitation that you'd typically think of, like driving or a car. And instead, it's making a character out of the idea of the film, right?
Sure.
Valhalla Rising is your Viking fantasy exploitation type film. Only God Forgives is based on the samurai film, but again, not because it's in Japan, not because of swords and Asian people.
Yeah, right.
It's this idea of revenge and fighting without guns and you're losing your brother and hating your brother and betrayal and having nowhere to go and being, you know, being a shinobi or being a samurai without a master and having to take revenge when you're not fully ready to be your own master.
Sure.
And it takes those elements and it puts them in the place that you're used to seeing samurai films.
Right.
Which is surrounded by swords and blood and fighting. But then it immediately pulls away as quickly as it can from what would be, I guess, a stereotypical look at that version of exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other important thing when you're dealing with Refn films is the title. And I know that that's stupid because we're in 2013 and typically titles don't mean shit.
It's like a newspaper, a different editor comes up with the title than the body.
I think that it's very important to look at Refn's titles to understand. I think that some of the most deep set clues are in the title.
Mm-hmm.
You take something like Valhalla Rising, which we discussed when we did the film, and Valhalla Rising invokes Norse mythology and the idea of Viking and dying in battle, right?
Yeah.
When you look at Drive and initially you go, oh, cars, right? Move fast. No, maybe this is about the drive of a human being.
Sure.
And the drive of a person to succeed.
Who is the real drive is right, the title exactly. question.
And so Only God Forgives, you wonder, okay, well, we've got this murder and Only God Forgives. I guess he's out for revenge. But the last thing we see this character do is stab his dead mother in the head.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think he stabs her in the gut because that's the womb point.
Right.
Right. But nonetheless.
I'm sitting there doing what you just said, right? I'm sitting there going, who is the real Only God Forgives? The entire movie.
Yeah.
And where are we discussing this point of forgiveness? And I think it's in the moment he stabs his dead mother. I think that's the moment you realize, okay, well, the villain all along hasn't been the villain we've been following. Because that guy, despite all his transgressions against this character, is now singing karaoke just like it's another night.
Chang might not be the kind of evil incarnate that the movie is trying to paint him as.
Well, and again, from a point of peddling backwards, the film goes, look at this cop stopping a criminal.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, cool, this cop's stopping a rape. Oh, wait, no, he's really manipulative. And the film backpedals immediately by championing this guy, saying this guy's against rape.
Yeah.
And this guy's horrible. And suddenly it backpedals and goes, he's a villain. He's got this crew of cronies. He sets out to get people killed. He's not a good guy. And we know virtually nothing about Ryan Gosling's character. The lead, we get almost no background on through the entire right. course of the film.
Sure.
And we're led to believe that, like in Drive, he's a fucking dynamo. And if you set him on a path, he's an unstoppable wrecking ball.
Sure.
Just because of his silence and his general fortitude towards situations.
Well, and that's a Refn thing too, right?
Right.
I mean, the big Far East Western with, you know, the modern cowboy is mm-hmm. your elevator pitch for the movie. Cowboy right. meets Far East kind of thing. And those are both the Western and the samurai film are movies that I think are probably of a huge interest to the director, especially given his, you know, love of the silent protagonist.
Right.
When I think silent protagonist, I think two genres of film, Western, samurai.
Yeah.
And Drive, silent protagonist.
Valhalla Rising, literally silent protagonist.
Oddly, Bronson, really fucking chatty protagonist.
Bronson so is that's the chattiest protagonist.
The chattiest person in the world. That movie's based around how fucking chatty he is. But Julian is, you know, for me, and I also think Only God Forgives is a movie largely left open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
It's shot like it's a series of photographs. Mm-hmm. You know, you could do this entire movie as stills. So little dialogue. I mean, it could be captions on photos from pivotal moments. If you're bored, please do that because I'd love to see it. But that's one of the things that adds to the eerie nature is you have people just kind of modeling in the frame. The camera's rolling and we're doing a 24 frame a second photograph of you stare over here, you stare up here, it's lit like this, and just let the camera roll for a while. And we move from scene to scene like that. It makes the little action we do have incredibly powerful, but it also adds to the eerie, the surreal nature of things, not to mention the you know, pseudo dream sequence
right.
Type stuff we're doing. But I look at it and think it's largely, you know, I think about the themes of family and of failure a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The movie makes me think a lot about failure. You know, I'd almost say it's a story about failure. When just considering, all right, what's the movie showing you? If I'm going to try and understand this, what are the things the movie puts on the table? A couple items, the actors, the setting, maybe, I don't know. But the characters, I mean, Julian's our protagonist. We have this guy who is, you know, represents the law or represents punishment or something, antagonism, I guess. Right. We have his overbearing mother to an absurd extent. I mean, the most ruthless mother you've ever seen in any film ever. No line too low to cross. These extremes of just calling out the metaphor and fucking, you know, has a dinner conversation, starts talking about the size of his cock immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's a movie just about disappointing his mother left and right. That's his entire relationship with her is through this disappointment, manipulation and disappointment. You know, the guy, his cover is, he's not much of a fighter, right? We see mm-hmm. that a couple times throughout the movie. We see him just fucking suck at fighting. Like you were saying, being built up with this idea of silent protagonist, ultimate badass, just gets his ass kicked, does not land a fucking punch. What is his cover? Boxing.
Yeah.
You know, run this boxing ring. So here he is, his mom disappointingly going, oh, he's not much of a fighter. So he runs away to Bangkok. His cover becomes own a fighting ring. I mean, it's as if everything he's doing is maybe not to impress his mom, but maybe, I mean, he brings the prostitute with him, pays her to basically impress his mother. Here, act like my girlfriend, wear this dress. That scene of him screaming at her
mm-hmm.
for being, I mean, that and any scene his mom is in, with everything being so still and kind of quiet and eerie. Wow, just seeing him lash out like that is, it's one of the things that makes this a very different protagonist than you saw in Drive. But his interactions with his mom, I think, are really telling. You know, she says these things. She talks a little bit about what happened with his father, but, you know, she's saying, I made a mistake or whatever. These guys are coming for me. I need you to save me. Do this thing for me. Just giving him another setup for failure. And then, he gets to that point where he basically fails to save his mother.
Mm-hmm.
She asked him to do this thing after constantly telling him he's not good enough, bringing up this reoccurring not being able to live up to his brother,
mm-hmm.
a rivalry that he doesn't seem that invested in, but his mom keeps bringing it up. Like, right. They were rivals. He's not as good as his brother. And then he fails to save his mom from dying, which brings you to the end of the movie. The first thing I considered in trying to figure out what the fuck is going on,
mm-hmm.
you go, what was that ending about? Right. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. that's one of the natural questions I think comes up, where he's having his forearms cut off or his hands or whatever. There's sort of a reoccurring motif of hands. You know, you see his hands are cut, you see the washing the blood off, and you mm-hmm. see, there's just a couple times we consider his hands. I don't know if you have any idea why we're cutting off arms at the end of this movie or what that's about. You know, I don't know. I'm trying to extend the metaphor a little bit
mm-hmm.
or go, okay, movie largely interpretive, just as much about feelings and emotions as anything else. I think about what are hands metaphorical for. I just get this feeling of helplessness. He's right. having his hands cut off. It's like having the phrase of having your hands tied in a matter.
Right.
As if he just couldn't fucking do anything. He is so useless, he might as well not even have arms.
Right.
It seems sacrificial, doesn't it? Plays into that Asian culture, seppuku kind of thing.
Yeah, it's either that or it's the other end of the spectrum that he was generally motivated by, one, probably beating his brother. I think that is uh-huh. actually a motivation for the character.
You think so?
Well, I think that's what causes him to not seek revenge is the partial vindication he gets from being the only remaining son. And so,
sure.
So as not to take revenge on the death of his brother, because partially he's kind of glad it happened.
Well, and I also think that's why the idea of putting his hand in the womb
right.
sticks out to me.
Right.
I mean, it seems ridiculous to say, but it's almost like he's just checking to make sure there's no more.
Right.
You know what I mean? His entire family is dead. He's got nobody's expectations to live up to now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he needs to put his hand in there and go, so no other brothers? Are you sure? Let me just check in here, make sure everything's fine.
Once his mother is dead, I think that is his basic fulfillment. I think, again, to go to the title of Only God Forgives, I think he hates his mother.
Sure.
I think he's forever trying to live up to her standards. I think he's trying to impress her.
Right.
But I think he hates her maybe just for bringing his brother into the world.
Well, because you can't help but think about what a scumbag his brother is,
right.
too.
Exactly.
We know nothing good about his mm-hmm. brother except, oh, he had his reasons.
Mm-hmm.
A fucking throwaway thing we never even, you know, come back to. We see his brother basically do what I think most people would consider the worst act of all time, a rape and murder of an underage girl.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to think of worse single instance things that, oh, I'm going to go out for the night. What's the worst thing I could possibly fucking do this evening? And that's the guy he's trying to live up to.
Right.
It's a weird thing. And I don't know what it means, but it is certainly strange that that's the bar for thing you have to live up to.
Right.
That's who you're trying to impress your mother by beating out. And what that must do to somebody psychologically is
sure.
you're not even as good as that guy. That guy is dead. Fear should be alleviated. Still can't impress your mom.
And I think that maybe part of the end of the film revolves around his work being finished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the phrase of, I wash my hands of this. I have no more attachment to this situation. And I think in this film, he has no more attachment to any situation.
Yeah, right, right.
With the death of his family, he is the proverbial washing the hands does not go far enough, perhaps.
Sure.
That's just another look at why the film ends in the place it does.
Yeah, I think it's just trying to conjure a lot of feelings at once.
Mm-hmm.
It is helplessness. It is washing his hands. Also, I don't think you can help but kind of feel this moment of relief when he sees that his mom is dead.
Right.
Just this kind of, don't have to live up to that anymore. I
right.
mean, his reaction is incredibly stoic, as is most things in the movie. And then, of course, ending, I mean, you couldn't really push that further than ending on stoic karaoke.
Right.
It's just one of the most bizarre and weirdest things. But when I look at ties to something like The Holy Mountain, it makes me think, all right, movie is largely about feeling and is therefore, I think, intentionally vague, intentionally left open to a lot of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
which maybe is what we sort of just did. Want to thank Flint Iron Stag, Meta Somerville, Maxwell Harley, and Hannah Hughes. And what was the other thing? Doublefutureshow.com. Find our email. You'll figure it out.
All right. Friday and Metropolitan next week here on Double Feature. If you don't like it, chapters, watch more fucking film.
Bye.